Hi, my name is Professor Tom W. Bell. I'm a professor at Chapman Law School, and I'm here today to talk to you about startup cities. It's a development I think that libertarians will find really interesting. So let's get started with just a preview of what I'm going to be covering today. We're going to start out with two easy questions and then one hard question. And we'll talk about how the Hondurans have tried to solve this hard question. And then I'll wrap up with some theoretical discussion about how you might create a startup city. Now, let me just clarify that I've had some clients that work in this area. I'm now legally consulting with a client that's active in Honduras, and I'm speaking only for myself, not for my client. Anything here today is purely academic. Let's talk about first, though, some terminology. Not everyone has heard this term, startup cities, and I was introduced to the term by these fine people at the Startup Cities Institute at University Francisco Marroquin in Guatemala. And they have adopted this for good reasons, I think. Let me share with you some of the alternative terms you might have heard that I don't think fit quite as well. Charter cities were introduced by Paul Romer. He's a brilliant economist, and they're kind of his baby, really. He has something different in mind than the people in Honduras and other folks who talk about startup cities. In Paul Romer's model, basically an outside country would go to a developing country and offer it the same government that it has back home. So the Canadians, for example, would go down to Honduras and run a city for them. Well, that's not exactly colonialism or even neocolonialism, but it's a little too colonial for people in Honduras. So I'm going to leave that term for Paul Romer and his crew and wish them luck. What about free cities? A lot of people like that. That's indeed what they started out with here first at Reason. One problem with that is it's associated with the free city of Danzig. It's a long story, not a happy one. It was a territory between Poland and Germany that basically the Nazis took over. A lot of people, they hear free city, they think the free city of Danzig, now Gdansk, Poland. And at any rate, it's not really an apt term because the cities we're talking about are only freer. They're not completely free. They're not sovereigns. They're not like Athenian city-states. So again, great term. Don't think it fits best for what we have going on here. The Hondurans like model cities, Las Ciudades Modelos, and that's great for what they plan. I'm going to tell you more about what they're doing in Honduras shortly. But let's just set that aside, model cities for the Hondurans. And with startup cities, we're talking about a more general phenomenon. I'll tell you more about what startup cities are in a minute, and we'll get to it through these questions. Let's talk about the difference between where you live and the government you have. I'm going to ask you an easy question. So do you like where you live? I know many of you live in LA. It's got beautiful weather. Your family's there, your job, your friends. Almost everybody likes where they live. If they don't, they up and move. That's an easy question. How about this one? Now, granted, I'm at Reason. I think I know how you're going to answer this. I used to live in LA myself, and well, I got out, despite the regrets. So those are easy questions, but here's the hard question. Why can't you have better government delivered to you? Wouldn't that be great? Now, I know some people will say, well, you can do that. You just need to get politically active. You need to vote. Okay, that is a solution. It's not a great solution. We've tried that. I mean, I vote. And I have pretty good local government, but I voted at California federal levels, and look what that's gotten us. By the way, I'm not to blame for any of that. I just want to clarify. So let's talk about the Hondurans. Now, so they have this issue too. I'm sure Hondurans love their country. It's a beautiful country. It's got wonderful natural treasures, a rich culture, but they've got some problems here. I put this screenshot of this video up here so you can look it up if you like. The PowerPoint's available online if you want to see it. I recommend that you look at this, but that's not really going to talk about it. That's just an example of a Honduran person having, alas, typically Honduran problems. These are some problems that the Hondurans are facing these days. This is a reason why they want to bring good government, better government to their country. I'm sure they'd love to stay in Honduras, but many of them are leaving for reasons like this. They have the highest per capita murder rate in the world these days. And the next contender, I just looked at this, is only around 60 people for every 100,000 people. It's a drug war, my friends. That's the problem, really. It's a U.S. export, one of the nastiest, and it's hitting the Hondurans where they live. As a consequence, the Hondurans are leaving. So people born in Honduras, 9% of the people born in Honduras have, at last count, and note, most of these people are undocumented, so this is probably an undercount, 9% of them are in the United States. And other people still stuck in Honduras, not everybody can leave, 30% of them say they'd like to move to the United States. Now, this has created a crisis at the border. Honduras has opened up sort of a diplomatic outpost near the Texas border because 600 people a week, they are shipping back to Honduras. Well, the Hondurans, you know, they'd like to have better government where they live, and they've tried it, and their answer to these problems are the ZEDs. That's a Spanish acronym for Zones of Economic Development and Employment. Another reason the Hondurans are leaving their home country is because they can't find jobs. So they want to bring the jobs to Honduras. That's the Honduran flag. And I want to walk through with you this really interesting legislation they've passed. It's very innovative. It's uniquely Honduran. That's another reason not to call these charter cities. That's Paul Romer's baby. What he has in mind is not what the Hondurans have in mind. I'm very impressed with what they've done here. It's very creative. It's very bold. It's by Hondurans, it's for Hondurans, and it's under Honduran control. They do not want even Canadians, much less Americans, coming in and telling them how to run their country. They want to do it themselves. I respect that. I wish them luck. Let's talk a little bit about how they plan to do it. There's a long history of what Honduras has tried in this area, and I've been writing columns in The Freeman, a fine publication by Fee, and you can look those up to find out more. I'm not going to go through the history of their various legislations and litigations they've been through here. We're just going to start with the legislation they passed about a month ago. This is a map, shows you where Honduras is, in case you forgot. I know it's not foremost in most of your minds. Let's talk about what they've done in this new legislation. They amended their constitution, and they passed this legislation. And here are some things. I'm going to walk through this quickly. We can talk more in the Q&A if you like. I'm going to walk through quickly some of the things in this really interesting law they've passed. So the Zed are part of Honduras, but they're autonomous entities. They've said expressly they want to create something like Hong Kong in Honduras. They set their own budgets, these Zeds. They have to be balanced. They set their own taxes. The statute caps the taxes at a certain low level. And they have to, you wonder what's in it for the Hondurans. Well, they want to create jobs. They want to basically try out some new modes of governance. But they also hope that these Zeds are going to generate a lot of tax revenues, and that'll help fund the Honduran government. The Zed are not, I've heard people say they're like privately owned cities, and there's going to be like a Mr. Burns cackling somewhere and rubbing his fingers together. That's nuts. The statute expressly says they have to respect human rights, they have to provide all these benefits to the people of Honduras. Again, it's by the Hondurans, for the Hondurans. Let's talk a little bit about the legal system. This is a picture of the Honduran Supreme Court, that building there on the left. Very attractive. Some parts of Honduras, very nice. Some parts, otherwise. Very interesting what they've done here. It's a civil law system, like, of course, most Latin American countries. But in the Zed, they so admire the way the common law has worked in England, America, Hong Kong. They have said in the statute, we want you to adopt the common law for the Zed. The Zed can choose their own civil laws. They get to choose their own contract law, their own tort law, their own laws of property. They have to respect certain human rights, but basically the Zed are allowed to do that. With criminal laws, it's a little different. Criminal laws embody certain values that are very important to the Hondurans. They do not want a new Amsterdam, not the New York kind of New Amsterdam, but they do not want a place that has, you know, people selling dope in the streets and prostitution and gambling, although actually prostitution and gambling are legal in Honduras. But the point is, they say, we have values in our criminal laws. You have to keep our criminal laws in these Zeds unless you pass new laws and we approve them. Again, showing you the Hondurans are in control. The Zed, however, control their own police. This is very important to investors and residents of these new territories, or will be, when and if they build them, because the Honduran police, let's say, they hope to learn from first world policing standards. It's another reason they hope to bring these Zed to their country. They want their civil servants to learn from the best in the world. Where will the Zed be? This is a nice little topographic map of Honduras. You can see how mountainous it is. They're not building a Panama Canal across this anytime soon. And if you look at this closely, you'll see there's dark lines, little dark lines that designate the departments next to the coast. Keep that in mind. Where will the Zed be? The Congress has to decree where the Zed will be, and they've not done that yet. So no one can really say for sure. Except they have specified that low population density areas near the coasts are already sort of pre-approved for the Zed. We still don't know where those regions are. There's an administrative body in the Honduran government that has to do a survey and make a report. We still don't know. It's very early. The legislation passed just last month. High population areas might want to form Zeds also. They need to hold referenda. So no one's shoving this down the throats of the Honduran people. They have to vote this into place if you're in a town or city. If it's in a low population area, there, because there are large tracts of land in Honduras that are privately owned, most notably by banana plantations, there the landowners have to opt in. Again, No one's forcing this on the Hondurans. They're choosing it themselves. Let's talk about the way the Zed are governed. This is a picture of the signing of the legislation. I was watching it online. It was very exciting. I mean, people think Honduras has some kind of, you know, terrible government, and I won't portray it as the best in the world, but look, they passed this legislation twice. They amended the Constitution. There was a lot of debate in the Congress, and still it passed by an overwhelming margin. So they're doing what politicians everywhere do. They're thinking about their people, doing the best they can. We should ask as much as our politicians. The president appoints 21 members of this committee for the adoption of best practices. It's a little bit like the legislature. It's really more like a board of trustees of the Zed. Congress approves them. This committee for the adoption of best practices appoints the technical secretary. And the people where the Zeds will be formed have some say on who that person will be. Has to be a person of Honduran citizenship, by the way. And the technical secretary is not quite just an executive, because the technical secretary can also pass laws. And then this technical secretary, this is the interesting thing for people who want to help the Hondurans in their project, the technical secretary can contract with outsiders, for-profit, non-profit, government advisors, whoever can help, to provide services in the Zed. So that's a quick look at what they're doing in Honduras. I'm sure you have a lot of questions about this. I have a lot of questions about this. And you know, we're working it out now, and we hope we'll get it all figured out. I want to turn to a different topic now. So you see now the potential here. It's a chance for people who care about good government from the private sector to help the Hondurans bring good government to their people. I think we have a lot to offer them. And the Hondurans like bringing in the private sector because why? A couple of reasons. One, it's not another flag on your soil. These are people under your thumb. You're hiring them to help you. You don't have to worry about, well, no one worries about the Canadians, but you don't have to worry about Americans, or maybe you do worry about Canadians. The Hondurans have been burned by colonialism. They have reason to be concerned. So you don't have to worry about somebody else flying a flag on your soil. And two, the Hondurans want to develop an industry. They're ahead of everybody else here. If the Hondurans figure this out, they're going to have locally grown experts in governing services who can go to other countries and advise them. The parties with whom I've been consulting have been talking, of course, with the Hondurans, but also other countries. This is perhaps, we're at the cusp of a new industry, and the Hondurans are right there at the front of it. I hope it brings a lot of prosperity to their people. But let's turn to theory now. Okay, I'm an academic primarily, and I've given this a lot of thought over the years. I've written about polycentric laws, it's called. I want to share with you some thoughts about how maybe perhaps one might help Hondurans and other countries create these model cities, charter cities, whatever you call them. I prefer startup cities. This is a screenshot from Future Cities Development, Inc. That was the first company I worked with. It was headed by CEO Patry Friedman. And this was back before the first time, this is the first time the Hondurans took a whack at this problem, and their Supreme Court found it unconstitutional, and FCD, out of respect for the commitments they made to their investors, had to fold up. But it was great working with Patry. He was right there on the cutting edge. And I put this up to remind you and really myself, you know, don't hyperventilate and get too excited about this, because probably nothing will happen. That's what happened last time. I run into a lot of libertarian fanboys and girls, and they get all excited, and I tell them, you know, my heart was broken once. I try not to get too excited. This is all just theory, folks. All just theory. Let's not take it too seriously. So let's talk about how you might do some of these things in theory. I'm going to offer you a few headings here. First of all, I'm going to describe a way to structure a city so that it's both a cooperative residential association and at the same time a for-profit corporation. This is kind of a new model. I think it's interesting to think about in theory. Maybe it'll work in practice. I'm going to talk about plug-and-play government, how that would work. It's a quick and easy way to build an entire city basically from scratch without a lot of civil servants who have tenure. I'll talk about this basic judicial building block, and lastly, corrective democracy. There will be democracy in the startup cities of some form. This is one way to implement it that I think is especially protective of private rights and individual liberty. Let's start with this first topic. This is actually, this was the same shot I had in my opening screen. This is actually a privately owned community. This is the largest cooperative residential association in the world. It's in the Bronx of New York City. It's called Co-op City. About 55,000 people live there in those high rises. It's got some very interesting features. Let's talk about how co-ops work and why they're appealing to people who like property rights. A corporation owns all the property in a co-op, and they lease it to the residents. But who owns the corporation? The residents own it. So the people who live in the co-op own shares of the corporation from which they lease the property. So it's a combination of kind of a corporation and a co-op. And these, as I've noted, get very large. 55,000 people in Co-op City. There are schools, shops, churches, offices, parks, everything you could want right there on site. And for a startup city, it's a very attractive model, but you need to tweak it a little. Why? Startup cities are, you know, could be built basically on, you know, open fields. You need a lot of infrastructure and investors. Investors might not be comfortable handing over the keys to people who live there alone. They might want a share of the corporation too. So you need to make the shareholders more diverse so investors can also be shareholders. And the use of a corporate structure allows you to do very interesting, innovative things with the vesting of shares. For example, you could set it up so that every year that you live in this residential cooperative, you get another vote so that old timers have more say in the management of the city. There's other things I could talk about here. I just want to point out that once you start viewing the city as like a corporation with shares, you can start distributing equity in ways that aligns the incentives of the people that live and work there with the city itself, and everybody benefits. Let's talk a little bit about, let me show you some more pictures. This is Co-op City from the city. You can see this is a real big deal. A lot of capital assets there. I'll show you another one from Letchworth, England. This too is another kind of cooperative residential community, but this one is more in the line of a pastoral English community. That's their entrance to their city. Streets, houses, very nice houses there. It's kind of an upper middle class community. I should note, by the way, Co-op City in the Bronx, solidly middle class. Solidly middle class. It's not just for rich people. Another picture from Letchworth. That's their downtown area. Let's talk about now a way to build a city from scratch. And I learned about this from my friend Paul Fine and this Reason TV video he created called Sandy Springs, Georgia, the city that outsourced everything. Brilliant what they did there. This is Oliver Porter, and he was a retired engineer. They wanted to create this new municipality in a kind of an exurb of Atlanta, and they needed to do it fast and cheap. And Oliver Porter figured out how to do it. He has a very lean municipal government, just a few employees, and they contract out everything. They put a request for bids up. They brought in people to fix the streets, to run the parks, to collect the garbage. They contracted with other cities to provide fire and police. And so it allows them to run the city in a lean and mean in the sense of cheap, not vicious, in a lean and mean way. I was very impressed by that, and I think we can even take that model farther. You can even outsource law. Remember, the Hondurans in their Zed said, we want common law. Well, where are you going to get the common law? They don't have it locally. What you could use, Randy Barnett suggested this in one of his books, is use the restatements of law. In the restatements of law, academics, judges, and lawyers have surveyed the decisions in the common law system and kind of summed them up in a statutory form. So it'd be very easy for a Zed city, starting from scratch, to simply take those restatements off the shelf and say, there's your law. We don't have to create a legislature. We don't even need to create judges. Someone has done the work for us. Plug and play in both city services and even in the law. I want to tell you about this little model I've been playing with now. I'm kind of excited about this because it uses Legos. I got one in my pocket here. My son let me use this for my talk. Let me tell you how this would work. Now, this is a basic building block of justice. I'm going to illustrate it here with some Lego blocks. Imagine that these two Lego blocks represent a plaintiff and defendant. They get in a fight. Maybe they're in a Zed, and they get in a fight over maybe some contract. One of them says, you shorted me. There are not enough bricks on this pallet. And the other one says, you're wrong. There are. Through their choice of law and choice of form clause in their agreement, they've already settled on how to resolve the dispute. Here's how they might do it. The two parties pick arbitrators. This is a method I got from AAA, the American Arbitration Association. They're not the only people who use this method, but they use it very widely. So the defendant picks one arbitrator, and the plaintiff picks another arbitrator. And those arbitrators pick a third arbitrator, which creates our panel. I put them up on a little Lego block there, which creates our panel of arbitrators. Now, what's the beauty of this? We don't even have a standing judiciary. We don't need a standing judiciary for this. You cobble together the panel from the choices of the disputants. And they can't deny that's a fair panel. Each of them gets to pick an arbitrator, the two arbitrators who are removed from the dispute and who take oaths, by the way, to resolve the dispute fairly and impartially, pick the third arbitrator. So that's the first element in this little building block of justice. And you can see there I've kind of merged it. So we got the first element. Let's talk about the next element. What can the arbitrators do? In traditional arbitration, the arbitrators frequently split the baby. What they do is one party says, I owe you nothing. The other says, you owe me $1 million. And the arbitrators end up around $500,000. In baseball arbitration, as it's sometimes called, I like to call it Baldy arbitration after Baldy Harper. Has anybody heard of Baldy Harper? He was the founder of the Institute for Humane Studies. And I first learned about this method of setting remedies in arbitration from something Baldy Harper wrote. In Baldy remedies arbitration, the arbitrators have to choose a remedy offered by one of the parties. None of this splitting the baby stuff. The problem with the splitting the baby approach is you aim for extremes. That does not encourage the parties to settle the dispute. With this kind of choosing the remedy, the parties realize, oh, if I aim for the moon, they probably won't choose my remedy. I need to be realistic. In fact, you go through three rounds of this in baseball arbitration. First, the parties start out here, and then they look at their offers and demands, and they get closer and closer to the middle. It encourages peace. And the last element is loser pays. Very common everywhere except the United States. Also encourages settlement of disputes. So the result is you combine those three things, you have a little building block. Every dispute can go to this little kind of neat little block, and that simple unit can be combined with other elements to create a whole city. You use this plug-and-play government. This is one of the blocks. Everything bound together by consent, people agreeing to live together under these rules. And that very simple judicial process, I think you'll find, will encourage parties never even actually to end up with their litigation. It encourages peace. It encourages peace, reaching agreement before they even litigate. A few more things here, corrective democracy. I wrote about this in the Freeman. Basically, the idea here is democracy can be okay. I often hear friends of liberty, classical liberals, libertarians, say bad things about democracy, and I understand why. Because one problem with democracy is if you give the keys to the masses, they drive the government into a ditch. The problem is democracy is not very good at building programs, but it is good at getting rid of things. With a corrective democracy, the people only vote against particular laws. They're able to say, it's like whipping your hand from the stove when it's too hot. The people say, ow, we don't like that law, get rid of it. Doesn't tell us what to put in its place. Maybe we put nothing in its place. Think about farm programs. If we subjected farm programs in the United States to this kind of corrective democracy, do you think they'd still be around? No, there's not that many farmers. We get rid of it. Think of all the programs we get rid of, all the bad laws. Corrective democracy works to prune away bad laws. We have other processes to put into place people who will create new good laws if we need new laws. Maybe we don't. So to wrap this up, I want to say the important thing about startup cities is, as their name suggests, they're experiments in consent. It's a way to let people try to bring more competition to governing services, lowering the costs of choosing governments, bringing good government to people so they don't have to up and go to it. It'd be great for the Hondurans, great for people in other countries. Ultimately, great for people in the United States. One reason I'm very excited about this is because I love my country. And I want to exercise some tough love here and say to the United States, step up your game. I want to see some competition for all the bad government I see in the United States. They're getting away with murder now, literally. I think they need to see more competition. This is a way to bring it. And of course, the Honduran Zeds are this very bold, very interesting, very innovative, very new, we don't know how it'll work out, program to help some of the worst off people in the world with perhaps the best hope for liberty. And theory suggests, but hardly mandates, some of the features I've described. This is just an egghead talking. Really what we need to do is have lots of people take a crack at these hard problems of governance. I certainly don't have all the answers. I'm not sure anybody does. And in the abstract, nobody knows what will work. What we need are lots of experiments and consent. Then maybe we'll find a better way for people to live together in peace and prosperity and freedom.